Why Europe?
Because I think in Europe you can get to the root of the problem. I mean, look, what happens is you get directives from Europe. And as we all know, 75% of our legislation is based on European directives. But it's usually 4 years later before anything happens over here. And then all of a sudden you've got TDs in the Dáil debating an issue that was signed over for by MEPs 4 years ago. And it's probably changed somewhat since then and will change in the future again. And before we know it, it's happened. And we don't feel we have time to debate it. I mean, we have our own legislation here, which we debate in the Dáil or the Oireachtas or with the House of the Oireachtas before we pass it through, you know, the first, second stage, third stage, whatever it is. But with EU legislation and directives, it's 4 years later it happens. We've forgotten that we signed it over. We've forgotten that we actually signed up for that. And I'll give you an example, the EU Migration Pact. We had MEPs in this country who disappear for 4.5 years. And I find it quite offensive to the voters. They disappear for 4.5 years. They turn up 4.5 years later, you know, to open a shop, cut a ribbon or something like that, just to get your votes again. Well, while they're over there, they're like the best boys and girls in the class. And they put their hand up for everything. And then that's not what the European Common Market was originally designed for. It was meant to be countries working together. Whereas now we're seeing this kind of almost like a dictatorship. And you're seeing all these European MEPs all just putting their hands up. But I think it's really going to change.
In what way is it a dictatorship?
Well, they feel that, well, look what we're sending over. They're all woke. I mean, you can disagree with that if you want.
But that's a different criticism than it's a dictatorship. I don't like who the Irish people have voted for as a different criticism than Europe's a dictatorship.
I feel that there's a huge amount of pressure on these MEPs to bring in laws. We saw what happened last week in Brussels, of course. And I'm not talking about the extreme and the right wing, but of course Nigel Farage and Viktor Orban wanted to have, you know, a talk in the convention. And every hotel they went to, it was closed down. So much so, the police were called to stop the event from happening. And this is what happens in the European Parliament as well. Debate, just like it is in the Dáil here, is shut down. For example, recently, Matty McGrath wanted to talk about immigration in Ireland. He wasn't allowed to have the debate. You're accused of being right-wing. You're accused of being racist.
Well, no, and sorry. And I'm not basing my whole campaign on immigration. Because people accuse him of being right-wing. He was not allowed at the time to do with the standing orders of the Dáil and how you get an item onto the agenda. I mean, they do discuss immigration.
But look at the time they've given to one of the most important pieces of legislation this country will ever see. We're handing away our sovereignty, our control over our own immigration laws, which are pretty good laws, by the way. They're pretty robust legislation. We're handing that over to the European Union. And it's allowed a half an hour in the Oireachtas to question the Minister of Justice. Are the people really informed about it? We're being sold it as some sort of wonderful package that's going to make a difference. Everything that's in that, we can do ourselves. We don't need permission from Europe to put reception centres at Dublin Airport. Mm. We don't need permission from Europe to have a fast-track system to process people quicker. We don't need that. We should be doing that right now. We have a Minister for Justice who doesn't even know her own figures at the moment when questioned by Michael McNamara. She has no idea how many people are being even deported. They've lost control of the situation.
But the fact that there is free movement of people, though, within the European Union, is that an argument in favour of some version of the EU Migration Pact? Whether you disagree with aspects of it, that there's a common approach. You talked about the purpose, the aim of the European Economic Community initially, and then the single market, and then the European Union as its descendant, is working together. Like, this is an example of working together.
But it's not.
You can't kind of say working together, but actually I don't want to work together on this one.
When it comes to the free movement of people within Europe, we democratically voted for that in a referendum. Mind you, it took two referendums. We democratically voted for that.
Yeah.
We knew what we were getting into. And I don't think we have a problem with that. And I want to say from the outset,
did we not vote for this in Lisbon?
Well, we didn't really. We didn't vote for what we see at the moment, which is a free-for-all and people being treated inhumanely, stacked up in tents on Mount Street.
There were people who campaigned in the Lisbon referendum who said this is exactly what we were voting for.
At no point did we suggest that we were voting for open borders. And that's essentially what we have at the moment. Now, I want to say, at the outset,
Where do we have open borders at the moment?
And I want to be abundantly clear.
You just said we've got robust laws in this country.
I'm going to come back to that in a second. We have robust laws that are not being implemented. I'll come back to the open borders in a second. But in this country, and I want to make it abundantly clear, diversity is our key. It's our strength. You know, people mix the two arguments up together. I hear politicians do that. Oh, what about the hospitals? And, you know, what about all the hospitality industry? We need people. Of course we do. And they benefit our economy wonderfully and greatly. And I love diversity in Ireland. I think Ireland is such a wonderful country and Dublin is such a wonderful city. But we can't have a situation where it becomes a free-for-all. And it has become a free-for-all when we see today that out of 7,000 people, only something like, I don't know, three people were deported. Even though many of them, and these are people who were refused asylum. There has to be a safe country to send people back to. We have to have a policy. And we do have a policy, but for some reason our Minister for Justice doesn't believe she can implement these laws. And if the laws are not adequate, they're our laws. Mm. Let's change them. You know, the idea that you can change laws. During COVID, it was what we consider an emergency. I believe this is an emergency. Change the laws.
What you being in Europe is going to do what in relation to all of that?
Okay. Well, firstly, the EU Migration Pact will change over time. Of course, every year that's going to change. Our quota on the amount of people we bring in will have to change. Those laws will have to change. They will be adapted over time. I want to be there for that. And I may not be able to stop the EU Migration Pact, although I would say everybody should talk to the local TD about that. I won't be able to stop that. But I wouldn't have said yes to it in the first place, like all our MEPs did, apart from two MEPs who didn't, and they didn't for different reasons altogether, and one didn't turn up. So I wouldn't be one who would have voted for that. And there will be other pieces of legislation like that and other directives in the EU, and I want to be part of it.
But relating to what, because I was looking through the website at the different, and listen, immigration and the EU Migration Pact, absolutely, I mean, that is within the bailiwick of the European Parliament and governing
bodies.
We've
got the Habitat Directive as well, which is there at the moment.
Irish government funding for NGOs, that has nothing to do with MEPs. Building more modular housing, nothing to do with Europe.
Housing,
hiring
no,
more
no,
hardy
on,
and tougher criminal sentences, nothing to do with Europe. Prioritising mental health and investing in step-down health.
Hold on.
No, it's like you're asking people to elect you to the school board to fix the potholes.
I am part of a political party who stand for common sense and all these issues. And when you talk about, for example, housing, yes, there's a lot to do with the EU in relation to housing.
But some of these are specifically yours.
No,
some
of
them
course.
Are the common
of
to
course,
the party.
Because, but you know but why? Because I want people to know who I am. Because if they think I'm tough
but when
on
it
crime.
Comes to Europe, you're a single issue candidate.
No, absolutely. But do you think I don't make a difference? Because everybody makes a difference.
So sorry, when I go onto your website and it's got four issues there, it's got immigration, it's got NGOs, it's got housing.
Yes.
And it has law and order.
Absolutely.
You're accepting that three of those are irrelevant in this campaign. You just said you're a single issue candidate. You just said it.
I never said that.
I said, are you a single issue candidate? You said yes.
Absolutely not. I care about a lot more. And I said to you three times in the last 15 minutes that immigration is not the only thing I want to talk about. There are so many other things we need to talk about.
What the things that you want to talk about? I just mentioned
the Habitat Directive. I mean, that's something that affects us greatly in this country. We want to move on, we want to progress. Clontarf is in a really bad situation at the moment. But again, the Habitat Directive stops planning on many occasions because there's a rare spider living somewhere. So all of those things are handled at European level. That affects planning, that affects housing. The reason that I talk about those other things like climate, like housing, like whatever it happens to be is because I want people to know who I am and what I stand for.
But we don't have a housing crisis because of rare spiders.
I'm not suggesting we do have a housing crisis.
No, we have housing crisis.
But we have planning problems
enough.
Because of rare spiders.
We have planning issues and the planning system is being overhauled. But again, I'm going to keep coming back to this. I mean, so many
issues. Agriculture is also a huge issue. I mean, look,
can you actually answer the questions I'm asking rather than the ones I haven't asked yet? Building more modular housing. Mm-hmm. What has that got to do with the European Union? And a lot of people getting in touch about that interview. And News Talk wouldn't be used to straight talking like Niall, more used to spouting government propaganda. And you won't read this out, I bet, says Noel. Noel, thanks for the text. Great to hear Niall Boylan, a passionate, genuine voice of reason, clearly patriotic, and he cares about the people of Dublin. But Sean says, oh dear God, is this shouty guy going for the full bingo card of cliches? I'd nearly vote for him if he'd promised to disappear for a few years as he claims the MEPs do. Is he sure he shouldn't be campaigning in the UK for the Reform Party? So says Sean. Well, listen, for what it's worth, Niall describes himself as Marmite, so I don't think he'll be surprised to see the text coming in on both sides of the coin. 087 1400 106 the number if you want to get in touch. Steve O'Timothy is with me in studio now. He is a comedian, but he is also a campaigner, longtime campaigner when it comes to road safety. And this on the day that the Road Safety Authority actually are before an Oireachtas committee answering questions about campaigns that they run to improve safety on our roads against the backdrop of an increase in road deaths last year and people worrying that we're looking at a similar increase this year. Steve-O, you're welcome to studio and thanks a million for making your way to us from Galway today. For people who don't know your story, maybe we will start there in 2005. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, in 2005, I made the worst decision of my life. I decided to drink drive on my bike. I was celebrating. I went back to do my Leaving Cert as a mature student. And I went back and it was the last exam that evening. as I done back in them days, get drunk, celebrate it. So I ran out of drink. I decided it'd be a great idea at the time to drive the bike into town and get more drink. So yeah, it didn't end that way.
You weren't alone.
No, I had John Laffey on the back, a friend of mine. Didn't have him first. I met him in town, and then after that, then we crashed on the east side of the city. I don't remember the crash. I don't remember much about it. Just remember waking up and, yeah, in extreme pain and just, yeah, it wasn't easy.
When do your memories start to reform? Is it like on the road post-crash? Is it in the hospital? How soon afterwards can you remember?
Kind of in the hospital, really. Like the next few days, people were like ringing me and things started coming back. But I knew, like, I met a balls in my life. Like, I knew that instantaneously, even in the book of evidence. I was in court for it, charged, and the book of evidence said that he admitted it on scene. So I even knew that morning when I was lying paralyzed that I just said, yeah, it was me driving, I did it. So I knew I'd met a balls of everything.
And we'll talk about John in a moment, but what impact did it have on you? So you're here in a wheelchair in studio.
Yeah, I use a wheelchair or crutches. I can stand or walk for short distances. So yeah, I broke two bones in my neck and seven or eight in my back, T4 to T10 inclusive, I think. And then my leg and shoulder, collarbones, all that kind of, the minor ones. But it was the spinal injury, T4. So it was upper, about the nipple line down, that I had no movement or no sensation from. So still limited sensation, limited movement. So I got a bit back.
John didn't survive the crash.
No. About a week and a half later, John died, but that was kept from me. So no one told me. It was kind of, I suppose, to protect me. And I suppose that was obviously the hardest point of the whole thing. I was up in the rehab hospital in Dunleary, and the physio was starting to go good, and I started getting movement back in my second toe on my right foot. I still remember it to this day. And I was out pushing myself and always like trying to steal crutches out of the gym to like try it myself out in the car park. Nearly got expelled from a hospital, however you do that. But yeah, I think it was about a month and a half then into it, the psychologist came in to talk to me, and she was just like, your dad is going to be ringing you at 2 o'clock. And I was like, that's strange. What, like, my dad had just ring me. You know what I mean? The outfit is like that. You know. And then the nurse came over and said, don't forget your dad is ringing at 2. So I knew then something was up. And I, like, looking back, I don't know how I can cop it. Like, they said he had damaged his legs, but he was up in Beaumont. And I never put two and two together that you wouldn't be in Beaumont,
yeah,
for broken legs. But I suppose it was my dad's way of protecting me. But yeah, he rang and he just goes, Stephen. And I said, yeah. And he goes, I've something to tell you. And I said, John's dead. And he said, how did you know? Who told you? And I said, no one. I just know by the way you're talking. And he goes, what are you going to do? And I just said, nothing. I just hung up and asked them to get the hoist, took me out of the hospital bed in my wheelchair, went downstairs into the kind of where the day room was, but it was late evening, obviously, and I locked myself in a bathroom and listened to music and smoked fags for the night. And that was, yeah, didn't... I always say, you're in an awful strange situation when even the option of suicide is taken from you by yourself. Because you... I know it sounds weird, but when you're in that situation, it's a comfort to know that I can leave at any time. I have that power. I have the power over my life to basically go. But when even that is taken from you because you're paralyzed, you can't get out of the hospital, you can't climb out a window, so you're literally trapped. Even the option of suicide was I took that from myself, even that. And I know it would have been a coward's way out, and everyone would say, yeah. But you didn't kill your friend in a drink driving accident. So
is that what your dad was getting at when he asked, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I always look back and lots of interviews and things, I always think of my dad having to make that phone call. Because he knew my mental state and he knew how I'd be. And he possibly had in his head, I'm ringing possibly and giving my son news that will end up with him taking his life, and I have to give him that news. So I
God, yeah.
I always kind of tried to give a bit of credence and give a bit of like how tough that was for him to do. And that I put him in that situation. It wasn't only destroying my life physically, mentally, John's life, John's family, but my dad and my family. Like, my dad had Parkinson's, my mother had dementia, there was learning disabled Jamie, and he has a learning disability, and then Ronan, my little brother, was only 8. And here's absolute twat coming home in a wheelchair. Here, mind me now as well. You know, so it's, yeah.
And talk to me then about the weeks or months afterwards. I mean, what did you imagine for your future? Or, you know, what were you thinking? Were you just thinking about kind of things on a day-by-day basis? Were you imagining what you would do now with all of this?
You couldn't really think about the future much because that was gone. You had no future. It was really day-to-day. It was just get through this physio, go out the back, smoke a few fags, the next day, try and get out of the hospital, I suppose. And that was my big goal, to get out of the hospital. Because I kind of knew at that stage, because my dad had went to John's funeral and met the family, and they weren't angry at me. And even to this day, John's son Thomas does be saying to me, like, "Why you stop blaming yourself? You were out drinking. He jumped on the bike. You know, stop." And I'd be all like,
Was that immediate with them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was never any anger or animosity. They were like, you were two friends that were drinking together, and it was kind of, you know.
How did you react to that? Because some people, and some people want people to be angry with them.
Yeah, I didn't.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I kind of didn't feel right. And it's like what I said earlier when I was in court and the judge gave me a suspended sentence and people were coming over, well done and stuff. And I was like, well done for what?
Yeah, you want to be punished. Yeah. You want people to be angry with you, to kind of because validate how low you feel about yourself.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, as a motorcyclist, you're responsible for your pillion passenger. And I failed in that responsibility.
Mm.
So you want to, but the judge said, look, you're paying a, you know, by your very, physically, when people look at you and see you. So, yeah. So, but like I said, I never crib about my condition. I give out, I suppose if I'm giving out to me, I'm angry at me for stealing that 23-year-old Stephen's future. You know, that kind of way. I ruined his life. I all see it as kind of distancing.
And is that how you think about your own life now in totality, is kind of two lives, kind of what kind of...
Oh yeah, if I'm talking to my girlfriend or brother, it's like before the crash. And sometimes I'd find myself going, oh, I could climb that wall. And then I go, no, I went from cycling and climbing mountains, cycling out to Clifton from Galway and climbing mountains, to being afraid of a wet leaf on a footpath, or afraid to stand up. You know what I mean? And I get bad spasms as well, which cause me to fall quite regularly. And it's kind of an everyday thing. But like I said, that's my penance. That's my, like, I'm alive.